Okay, hello again, Masechet Tanit, live from Wed B'Yeshiva and Mishkan Sipora. I'm Jeff Sachs. We are on Daf Kof Amud Beis. You know what happened? We were ahead of the Daf Yomi, and then the Daf Yomi caught up to us, I think. But, if you hang around, if we keep going, we might finish the whole Masechta by the time we get around to the next Daf Yomi. We spent quite a bit of time last week on that little Agadah. That wasn't my intention, but it was quite interesting, I think. And it happens that this Perek is chock full of Agadot. And, Agadot, classically defined, an Agadot in the sense of, kind of moralistic teachings, not the heavy lifting of Lamdus, but instructive and interesting nevertheless. And that's a little bit what we have on tap for. That's what we have on tap for tonight. The Mishnah had said, "V'chein ir sheyesh ba dever o mapolet v'chule." If you have a city that's got the plague, or if it has mapolot, it has building collapses, which, in the ancient world probably was a little more frequent than it is today. But even today, we have, these things do occur. We had the tragedy on Lag BaOmer. It was not exactly a building collapse, but something of the sort. And, even the history, even in our own memories, we remember the Ulam Versailles. What was that, about 25 years ago or so, in Talpiot and the like. But buildings which were held together, any multi-story building, was inherently, I guess, a kind of structure that would give people pause. I remember when they were putting up the Gesher Meitarim in Yerushalayim, the big suspension bridge at the entrance. So for however long they were constructing it, there was all type of scaffolding all around it. And for a while you couldn't, all the traffic was being rerouted while they were putting it together. And then they put up that big, the central pole, and they started stringing together the cables that hold it up. And then one day they just took all the scaffolding away, and the whole thing is held up by the, that's the way suspensions work. It's held up by its own weight. But before they took the scaffolding away, I was coming back from the airport in a taxi, and we were coming in underneath it, like very late at night, and the taxi driver said to me, "When they take away those supports, I'm never driving under this thing." Because it just looked so perilous, the idea that it was going to be held up by these cables. But we'll see that concern that a taxi driver had in the early 2000s is an ancient concern. It's here in the Gemara. So Tanu Rabbanan, mapolet sha'amru briot velo ru'ot. The Mishnah had said that if a city has a plague or buildings collapsing, so then there's the whole series of fasts and calling out on the shofar and all of the other things. These are among the indicators, like lack of rain, that the city has to engage in the fasting and repentance business. So Chazal want to qualify, which kinds of building collapses do we require? That's when we're talking about sturdy buildings, briot, and not shaky buildings. If a shaky building collapses, so then that's not an indicator that there's some kind of moral rot in the city. It's an indicator that you had a shaky building, which probably should not have been left erect. From time to time, the city should come around and condemn buildings that are dangerous. And if they collapse, that's not a sign of God's expressing his displeasure.
This is that mention of like lo ruot is something that I always find to be fascinating, because there's a famous, I don't remember, it's a very famous Gemara, I don't remember where it is, about the Elisha ben Abuya, and he sees the there's a story of the guy climbing up on the ladder, and he's and he's doing Shiluach HaKein and Kibud HaVeim, and he falls down. So Shluchei Mitzvah shouldn't be. And they say, well, that's only if Shluchei Mitzvah shouldn't be damaged, only if the latter isn't Ra'ua.
Right.
It does this amazing job of separating between what is a metaphysical thing and when, if we're not going to be responsible, God's not going to start taking care of us for it. It's a fascinating idea. It's not
right.
So obvious. Most people don't assume that ladder would not have been, sturdy.
Right. That's actually plays into the conversation, David, you and I had this morning about the long footnote at the end of chapter 8 of Lonely Man of Faith. Right, about what does it mean? What does it mean that we, in the Lonely Man of Faith in chapter 8, Rabbi Soloveitchik has this idea that, unlike some other faith communities, Judaism, at least the Soloveitchikian brand of Judaism, is rather rationalistic and sees in scientific knowledge a necessary ingredient in which to fulfill our religious obligations vis-a-vis the world in which we live. Right? So he talks about, as opposed to certain other faith traditions which view with skepticism medicine and science. Now, I don't know who he was talking about then. Maybe he was talking about Christian Science or the J Witnesses or whomever. But today, you can look at the people that have certain opinions about vaccines against all medical knowledge. I do not mean to offend anyone who may be subscribing to that opinion, but you should get vaccinated. So he says, Judaism believes that, you have to understand science and you have to understand medicine. And there's a religious obligation of rapo yirape. You have to heal the sick. And pikuach nefesh is a religious obligation of the highest order. Of course, the very well-known stories about the Rav's grandfather. There was once a cholera epidemic in Brisk on Yom Kippur, around Yom Kippur. And Reb Chaim insisted that everyone eat. And he himself, on the bima, on Yom Kippur, made kiddush and ate so that other people should see that he meant this very seriously. Because I think the feeling was that if you were fasting, you were more susceptible to get the cholera. And people said to him, how can you be so makel, lenient about eating on Yom Kippur? So he said, I'm not lenient about eating on Yom Kippur at all. I'm machmir, I'm stringent about pikuach nefesh, about saving lives. So the Rav says that is the religious obligation, but that doesn't contradict the idea that we have faith in God, that we pray to God for health and healing, right? These are not contradictory ideas. They're part of the dialectic of the religious man in the modern world, that we can hold on to both ideas simultaneously. So I think that's reflected in what you say. The idea of Shomer P'tayim Hashem, that God looks after the simple, does not work for someone who intentionally makes himself simple. But there's somebody who says, I'll have probably one more drink than I should have, and I'll still get in the car and drive, because Shomer P'tayim Hashem, God looks out for the simpleton. Right? So if you say that, it doesn't work for you. It doesn't, right? It can't be how it works. We'll come back to this idea momentarily not relying on miracles. Is a similar idea. So where were we? So hey nihu briot ve hey nihu shenon ruot lipol. So the Gemara says, isn't this redundant? In other words, the Braisa had talked about walls that are sturdy and walls that are not likely to fall down, hold on a second. I'm teaching. Could everyone hold it down, please? Hello? So the Gemara says, "Lo tzricha denaflu machamat govaihu." There's a different category, right? We need to state both clauses, as it were, those which are sturdy, and those which are not liable to fall down. Aren't those synonyms? Isn't that the same? Isn't that the same? The case, isn't it repetitive? So the Gemara says, no, it's required. We must state both of them because of the case of a building that fell, not because it was unsturdy, but because it was too tall. Right? There were limits. I don't know, and presumably others do. I see that Yehudi is not with us, which is unusual, but he no doubt would contribute something to our conversation. And if not, he would have done the research in advance in terms of what in, you know, in I don't know, third, fourth, fifth century Bavel was the maximum height of a house you could build. But probably a two-story home was, you know, on average, the most you could expect. At a certain point, the whole structure, without the kind of building technologies that we have, where you dig a foundation and you have supporting beams that can hold a great amount of weight, no matter how sturdy the building is in its structure, at a certain height, it just cannot, with the weight, right? The weight of the building, it's going to all come toppling. It's all going to come toppling down. De kaiman agura dinahara. Right? Or alternatively, a sturdy building. Right? You could have a sturdy building, but nevertheless it's liable to fall down because of its height. You could have a sturdy building that nevertheless is going to collapse because it's built on a riverbank. And if you build on a riverbank where the ground is wet and shifts and is not stable, so the building is going to come crashing down, and therefore, if it does, that's not necessarily a sign that you have to go off and do tshuva. So now we get into these agadic portions. Kihahi, you see where we are? Kihahi. Kihahi ashita ru'ua dahava benahardo. Just like that old decrepit wall that was in Nahardo. Nahardo was one of the Babylonian cities, one of the centers of the yeshivot in Bovel. Delo hava chalif Ravu Shmuel. And Rav and Shmuel were always very careful not to walk under that. I said a house, I meant a wall. A shita is a wall. There was a wall that was like a little dilapidated. And Rav and Shmuel were always careful. If they were walking, they would cross the street. They wouldn't walk underneath that wall for fear that it could collapse on any moment and do them in. Afal gav dekaima ba'atra tlei sarshnin. Even though that wall had been standing there for 13 years. Hello, Rhoda Burstein. Welcome.
Thank you.
I think you're new to us. Where are you from?
Muncie.
How nice.
Thank you.
Nice to know.
I guess I'm not muted.
You're not muted, but that's all right. We're a small group, and you're welcome to participate. This is a group of people we've been learning for quite a while together, but we always welcome new people. We're here in the middle of Masechet Ta'anit on Daf Kof Amud Beis. And it's nice to know that there are, you know, women in Muncie that are still learning Gemara.
Actually, I don't usually learn it, so
okay.
I'd like to.
Well, welcome. Yom Echada Ikla Rav Ada Bar'a Valahatam. So one day, while Rav and Shmuel are being careful not to pass by this dangerous, dilapidated wall that's been around, that hasn't fallen down yet in 13 years... So one day Rav Ada is with them. So Omar le Shmuel Rav, Nete Mar Nekif. Let's go. Let's walk around. Let's take our normal detour to avoid this wall that we're afraid is going to fall on us. So Omar le Lotzrich Nahidna. We don't need to worry about it today. De'ika Rav Ada Barava. Because this other holy roller is with us. Right? The Nafish Schuta, Velo Mistapina. He is a great bar schut, Rav Ada Bar Ava has so many merits. He is so righteous. He is so holy that we don't have to fear that if we're walking down the wrong side of the street with him in our company, that the wall, the shaky wall, is going to fall and get us. Because after all, I mean, you and I, Rav and Shmuel, you know, we might be goners. But if we're in his company, we're protected by his zchuyot. I mean, I guess they didn't fear that the brick would fall off the top and smack the two of them on the head while missing Rav Ada Bar Ava. But they figured in his presence they were safe. I mean, you know, we've all felt this at times, right? You know, you remember you were a little kid, you were walking someplace a little shady, like a dark alley at night. But, you know, you were holding your father's hand. And you figured, as long as my father's with me, well, nothing bad could happen. So that's what they felt in the presence of Rav Ada Bar Ava, even though normally they didn't walk near this street. But the story gets even better. Rav Huna Havale Hahu Chamra Bahahu Beta Ri'ua. So Rav Huna had a wine cellar. He had barrels of wine in a certain rickety house. I always think of remember the haunted house from like the amusement parks? They always looked like these rickety houses that were about to collapse. So in this house he had chamra, he had barrels of wine, and I guess he was afraid if the house collapses, the barrels of wine, they probably weren't barrels, they were probably in clay jars. So, you know, like a house comes tumbling down on a clay, what's the word, not a flask, a jug of wine, I guess so. I don't know, what do you call a big, the equivalent of a barrel if it's made out of charis, David.
What's the...
That's a fancy word, right? But a big barrel of wine, a big jug of wine. He was afraid the house is going to collapse. He's going to lose his whole storehouse of wine. Bo'i lafnuye. He wanted to move the wine to a more safe place. But what's the problem? He didn't want to go into the building because he was afraid the building was going to collapse while he was in it. So, Ale l'Rav Ada Bar Ava l'hatam. It happened that Rav Ada Bar Ava was also there at that time. So, who's Rav Ada Bar Ava in these stories? He's your get out of jail free card. He is your get out of shaky house free card. If he's with you, you are safe. There is no fear that harm will come to you while you are in his company. So Rav Huna knew as long as Rav Ada Bar Ava was with him, he could quickly get the wine out. So Mashche Bishmata Adefnuye. So he kept him there. He kept draying out the conversation for as long as it took him to move all of the stock of wine out of the house, because as long as he had this Rav Ada with him, he wouldn't have to worry. But since it took a certain amount of time to do the job of moving the barrels of wine, he had to schlep him out in conversation to get the job done. Bata denafik, nafal beta. As soon as they were out, boom, the building, now void of all of its wine, the building comes crashing down. Argish Rav Ada Bar Ava ikpid. And Rav Ada figured out what was going on, and he got angry. He got agitated that he had been, why do you imagine he might have been annoyed? He was annoyed because his time was being used in that way. He was annoyed because...
Well, he might have been annoyed because they brought him into a house that they knew was dangerous. Who knows if it was going right. to... You know, just because it worked out one time doesn't mean it was going to work right. Every time.
In other words, these are the miracle stories that others told about him. But he may not have had as much confidence in his righteousness that no harm was going to befall him. I mean, after all, Rav Ada Bar Ava knew from time to time he stubbed his own toe. Rav Ada Bar Ava knew from time to time he bunked his head, right? Rav Ada Bar Ava knew that even though, you know, even if he had an accurate portrait of his righteousness and his place vis-a-vis heaven, you know, he knew that these kinds of wonder tales that are told about the righteous are sometimes exaggerated. Right? One wonders what, you know, the righteous about whom such tales are told actually think about those wonder tales. I mean, there's value to them, of course. Certainly in Hasidut, you know, which made much of the kinds of tales of the righteous and the miracles they perform, it was a very useful mechanism to deepen faith and to, you know, orient the Hasidim towards proper values and to substantiate the leadership of the Rebbe for all of his good, important works on behalf of Torah and charity and wisdom, etc. But the Rebbe might have known that, you know, they're telling some stories about me that are really a little exaggerated. So maybe that's what's going on here. And he's annoyed that, you know, maybe the house almost fell on him. So the Gemara says, Savarle, he thought, Rav Ada Bar Ava thought, Ki had amar Rav Yanai. Le'olam al ya'amod adam bimkom sakana. Vayomar osin li nes. Shema ein osin lo nes. Or alternatively, maybe Rav Ada Bar Ava thought that indeed he was the recipient of all these miracles, that no harm could befall him. Except he also knew that one should never come to rely on such miracles. Right? And that's the, he quotes, Savarla, he believed, he agreed with the opinion of Rav Yanai, who said that a person should never put himself in danger relying on a miracle, because perhaps the miracle will not occur. That's our general principle of Ein Somchin Al Hanes. Even in the time when miracles were abundant, we, in our sins, now at the end of 2021, we don't live in a time of Nisim Gluyim. We don't live in a time of miracles happening left and right. Right? Our miracles, if they occur, are hidden, and they're sometimes difficult to even be aware of and interpret. But even in the times of explicit miracles, one cannot come to rely on them. Even if, objectively speaking, the world believes that you are worthy of a nis. So he didn't like the fact that he was misused in this manner, that he was like the lucky charm, right? The rabbit's foot. You know, if you rub your, remember those? We used to get them when we were kids, these, I hope that they were fake. These little, you'd win them at the carnivals, these little rabbit's feet, which were considered lucky, and if you rubbed it, nothing could go wrong, or your lucky penny, or these other type of superstitious nonsense things. It was just the thing, the rabbit's foot was not very lucky for the rabbit, after all, was it? You know, so he felt that he was being used as a lucky charm, and he didn't think that was a good idea. And even if you believe that a miracle will be performed for you, minakin lo mischuyotav. Nevertheless, even if a miracle is performed for you at command, it comes off your cheshbon. It comes off of your reward in the next world. What? So even if he thought that he could command the miracle, he didn't like the idea that it was coming on his, it was going to be deducted from his account at the end. Omar of Chanan, Maikra, this is the pasuk from Parshat Vayishlach, which we read a couple of weeks ago. Katonti mikol ha-chasidim u-mikol ha-emet, says Yaakov to Esav. What does it mean, katonti? He reads it as, I have been diminished, katonti, right? I have been made katan on account of all of the chesed that was done to me. If if a miracle is performed for me now, I am reduced because it comes off of the merits that I have banked. Okay. Umay hava ovde drev adabarava. So the Gemara wants to know, what were these great ma'asim? For what reason was Rav Ada Bar Ahava so regarded? What were his schuyot? What were his characteristics for which everyone thought he was a person who could command a miracle? All of these agadot, no doubt people have written on this, but when we're done looking at the perek, we'll have to go back and look over all of these agadot, because there are certain themes that run through them. You remember I told you that perhaps one of the most well-known agadot in all of Shas is coming up in this perek, and that's the agadah of Choni HaMa'agel, who can command rain, who can force God's hand, right? Who through some kind of use of, it appears on the surface like magic, but through some manner is able to make God, to bend God to his will, to bring the rain, right? These themes, these agadot, interrelate in ways that we'll have to explore. So what was the trick of Rav Ada Bar Ahava? Ki ha de itmar, Sha'alu Talmidav l'Rav Ada Bar Ahava, b'ma herachta yamim. They asked him, the students asked him, how did you merit such a long life? What's the secret to your righteousness? Amar lehem, mi amai, and then he lists all of his different, he catalogs all of his different virtues. These things are not exactly mitzvot. Right, they're all personal virtues that he pointed to as being sources of merit, and which he presumed was the source of his long life. So, what were his customs that were the sources of merit? Amar lehem miyamai lo hikparati betoch beiti. I never got angry at home. That's a great merit, right? I wish I could be like Rav Ada Bar Ahava, right? Not just
by the way,
because
it's I think it's maybe significant that it says loik paditi,
right.
So but first of all, in the early
he was makbid, right?
And where
in someone else's home.
In someone else's house, but in right. house, like in his house. Like, in my house, right. I'm not getting angry. If you bring right. me something else, house is falling down, I'll
right.
get angry. Like,
right. That was the, right. Yeah, in other words, that connection is almost the author of this piece of Talmud almost is setting you up to notice that, right? But in terms of Shalom Bayit, in terms of his relationship with his wife, his relationship with his children, he was not one to get angry. Velotz arati bifnei mi shegadol mimeni. And neither did I ever walk ahead of somebody who was greater than me. I presume greater in Torah, right? He showed a certain amount of kavod haTorah to those that knew more than him. He showed a certain amount of tzniut. Velo hirharti b'mivaot hametunafot. And I never hirharti. I never thought about presumably Torah in filthy places. V'lo halachti arba amot below Torah below tefillin. And I never walked four amot, I never walked a short distance without Torah, meaning without thinking of Torah, and without tefillin, without wearing tefillin at the times when it's appropriate to be wearing tefillin. You know that our custom is we wear tefillin, you know, essentially just for davening. In the times of Chazal, many were accustomed to wear tefillin all day long, at least during the daylight hours. But tefillin cannot be worn in certain places, in the privy chamber, in places that are dirty and filthy, and otherwise inappropriate. So presumably when he said, v'lo hirharti b'mavot metunafim, v'lo halachti below Torah, you see Rashi here in yellow says, "Dechol she'ata havegoris." He was always learning Torah. He was always learning Torah. So since in Mikomot Metunafim, in dirty, filthy places, you're not allowed to learn Torah, he never went there. Right? But the idea of Velo Hir Harti b'mivaot ha-metunafot, right? Hirhur means mental energy. Right? To think about something, to consider something, to muse on something. There's an interesting way to think about this. You know that there's a halacha of Birkat HaTorah. Before we study Torah in the morning, you have to say Birkat HaTorah. My wife is a knowledgeable, learned woman who is a teacher of Torah. And when we were first married, she would often get up before me to prepare for her teaching and for her learning and other things. And I'd get up in the morning, and I'm a slow riser until I've had the coffee. And we have a slogan around here, no talkie before coffee, right? Don't even try to talk to me until I've had my first cup. But I would wake up, I'd be half awake, I'd have one eye open, and she'd already be asking me questions like, what do I think about this, and what, you know, about this perek in Tanakh, and that posuk, and the other thing. And I would always be able to silence her by saying, I haven't said Birkat HaTorah yet. I can't discuss this with you. Right? And just like we can't eat food before we say a bracha, we can't study Torah before we recite the bracha, even though there are different categories of brachot. So the truth is, the halacha states that although one is not allowed to study or speak of Torah without Birkat HaTorah, one is allowed leharher b'divrei Torah before you say Birkat HaTorah. Right? You can think about Torah in your head. Right? So if you think about Torah in your head, however God keeps his books, right? God keeps score, he keeps track. There's a meter in heaven that tracks all of your mitzvah points. Maybe he has a computer now, I don't know. Hirhur divrei Torah, thinking about Torah, right? You're in the car on the way home, you know you have to teach Masechet Ta'anit tonight. You're thinking in your head all by yourself about the Gemara that's coming up. You fulfill the mitzvah of Torah study. But you do not need to say Birkat HaTorah over such study. So how can it be? If it is in fact a form of Torah study, how can you get away without saying Birkat HaTorah? Or to put the question differently, why is Torah that's spoken, meaning not only mental, but verbal, the type of Torah that requires Birkat HaTorah? So Rabbi Soloveitchik explained that even though hirhur, the kind of silent mental cognition of Torah, is a lower form of Torah study, it does not pass the threshold for which you're required to recite a bracha, because it's an inferior form of Torah study. In what way is it inferior? Because it is not dialogical. Torah study in its fullest expression is always a dialogue. Sometimes if you're all alone, it's a dialogue that you conduct with yourself. But without the speech act, you cannot teach others. And if it's Torah which cannot be taught and shared with others, then it's in a subsidiary category and does not require Birkat HaTorah in order to engage with it. Right? Torah study, according to the Rambam, you know, there's no such thing as learning Torah. According to Maimonides, there's no mitzvah to study Torah. Isn't that rather shocking? He does have, after all, a whole book called Hilchot Talmud Torah. According to the Rambam, there is one mitzvah with two sides to it. To study and teach. Lilmod ulilamed, which in Hebrew are just conjugations of the same verb. In English, you don't have that. Teaching and learning are two different activities, linguistically speaking. But in Hebrew, lilmod ulilamed are two iterations of the same act. But there are, of course, many expressions of this in our literature, of mikol melamdai hiskalte umitalmidai yoter mikulam. I learned much from all of my teachers, but from my students most of all. The greatest way to study is, of course, the greatest way to learn is, of course, to teach. The teacher is the greatest beneficiary of the endeavor. And since learning in your own head, until Apple or Google will figure out a way that my thoughts can go directly into yours, and then we'll have to re-examine the sugya, learning alone in my head can never achieve the teaching aspect, the sharing aspect. Therefore, Hirhur Torah is of a lower level. But nevertheless, Hirhur Torah is a form of Torah study. And Rav Ada Bar Ava, he wouldn't even do Hirhur Torah in the Mekom Metunafim, right? Because it's not a proper place to study Torah. Velo Yashanti, what were his other great virtues? Velo Yashanti Bevet HaMidrash. He never slept in the Beit Midrash. Lo Shenat Keva, Velo Shenat Arai. Neither a proper sleep nor a nap. You know, if you've ever spent any time in a Beit Midrash, or even just in a library, you'll notice there are people that'll put their head down. There. When I was in yeshiva, there was a guy, an older guy in the kollel, who wore tefillin all day, you know, like this. And there are still certain people who wear tefillin, not just for tefillah in the morning. Sometimes in yeshivot, you'll see people that'll wear tefillin as long as they're sitting in the Beit Midrash and learning. And then when it comes time to go to lunch, they'll take their tefillin off. And when they come back after lunch, they'll put their tefillin back on. So this is one guy. Who used to wear tefillin. He also used to learn out loud, very loud. He used to scream his learning out loud. You know, there's certain personality traits that go together. And but he would also take naps at his desk in the Beis Medrash, almost like I think people used to joke that he had like narcolepsy, because like he'd be like learning with great energy, and then suddenly they'd turn around and he was fast asleep, snoring away. And you take like a power nap, a cat nap. But you know, it's forbidden to sleep with your tefillin on. You can't even dremel with it, because tefillin require a very high level of concentration and kavana, which is counterindicated by being asleep. So he'd be learning and screaming and davening, and then suddenly he'd like rip his tefillin off, right? Stuff them into the bag, and then like conk out. He'd put his head down, it looked like he was doing tachanun or something, and he'd sleep for 10 minutes, and then he'd wake up and go wash Netilas Yadayim and put his tefillin back on. But Rav Ada Bar Ava, he wouldn't even take a nap in the Beis Medrash, even though technically speaking, it's permitted. But it was a kind of mark of righteousness that he took his learning seriously. He wouldn't sleep in the Beis Medrash. Velo sasti betakalat chaveri, and I never rejoiced at the errors of my companions. You know, that's in the tefillah of Rav Chanan ben Akana in Brachot, about, you know, we say in the tefillah that you say when you go into the Beit Midrash that you shouldn't rejoice in somebody else's error. You know, the arena of learning, the comparison of Torah scholars to gladiators fighting it out in the arena of ideas. The idea that if your opponent makes an error, you should never rejoice in the error of your opponent. Because after all, he's not really your opponent. This is not actually bloodshed, the battle to the death. It's the struggle together to find truth. So if somebody makes an error in the back and forth, the rough and tumble, the shaklavataria of a Talmudic debate, you shouldn't rejoice in that.
I never called my friends by a nickname.
The Omri law, and some say what he meant to say was he never called them by Chanikato, right? By a kind of derogatory name. A Kinui or a Chanika are two different types of nickname. You see, Rashi says here, Hachinato shemechanim lo b'nei Adam kegon shem lavai. A nickname that people, you know, people have nicknames, right? You have your proper name and you have like your nickname, right? Like a David here. Some people call him Dudi. Right? So, I don't know. That's a nickname. In Israel, it's a nickname. In America, it's not so much a nickname, right? But he thought it was a sign of respect to call people by their proper name. And certainly never to call someone by a derogatory name, particularly in the days before there were family names. I mean, proper family names, the way that we have, there were nicknames that would stick to families often. Agnon has a story. It's actually relevant to this week's parasha. Agnon has a story called Hatsfardaim. In English, it's called the frogs. David, if somebody's on YouTube, you can find it. Just Google Sax Agnon Frogs. I recorded a version of this last year for Parshat Ve'era for the 929 project about how this piece of Hebrew literature is a kind of midrash on the midrash on the pasuk about the Makat Sfardaim, the plague of frogs in this week's parasha. But that it's a story about a family in the late 19th century, mid-19th century, in Buchach and Agnon's hometown, who were nicknamed the Frogs. And nobody even remembered why the family was nicknamed the Frogs, the Frog family, because it had been around for so many generations. But the narrator of the story, he knows why. He knows why this family was nicknamed the Frogs. It was because of this particularly outrageous story, which was no credit to the honor of the family. This is the way it is. Nicknames. I remember when I was a kid in like second grade, there was a new kid moved into town, moved into school, came to school. He was a really big kid. I mean, he was big. He was like a good 6 inches taller than the other kids. It could be he'd been held back a grade or something, so he was like a year older. So at that age, it makes a big difference. And he was big. He was, he was a zaftig boy. He was a heavy set boy. And even like years later, I was in school with him all throughout elementary school and high school. And then after that, you'd see him around town. He was a heavy set fella. So somebody on the first day of second grade, he came to school. Somebody gave him the nickname Bubble. Because he kind of, I guess, looked round. And then Bubble got shortened to Bubba. And even though he was not some southern good old boy, that's a nickname for certain in certain like Alabama to call somebody a Bubba, right? But yeah, this was New Jersey. But for the rest, from that, I was there. I remember being on the playground in second grade when this new kid showed up. And I remember exactly the kid that gave him the nickname, Bubble. Said, hey, that kid looks like a bubble. And for years later, for years and years and years and years, this kid was, and everybody called him that. And I think even he like gave up and accepted the nickname, And then like when I got older, when I became an adult, it occurred to me how cruel that all was, right? That somebody called him by a foolish nickname on the playground yard. And, how much did that, like, define his identity? A person's name is so central to their identity and how others think of them and how they think about themselves. And I think of how cruel that was that I was thinking about this in advance of knowing I was going to mention this tonight. And I looked them up on Facebook to see if I could find him. If I could find him, I would tell him how sorry I am that we all did that to him back then. But that, so Rav Huna, Rav Adbarava, was makbid. He never called anyone by a nickname, not a derogatory nickname, not a regular nickname. He called people by their proper names.
When remember writing about Chanukah and how it was like as a surname.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other places in the Gemara where it doesn't mean a derogatory surname.
No.
And,
right.
So is it possible that he just wouldn't refer to people by their surnames at all?
No. I think Rashi here says. Rashi here mentions the Gemara in Gittin. In other words, in the time before modernity, when nobody had family names the way that we do, the Chanukah was the kind of family nickname which would be inserted into Gittin. Right? In other words, it functioned more or less the same way as our family names do today. So for the purposes of a get, in a get where you write a person's names and you write their nicknames and all these other things. So there, he puts it in as if a family does have such a name, if that family in Buchach, somebody from that family got divorced, you would write Mimishpachat Hatzvardaim, from the frog family, even though it wasn't their legal name for any matter, but it was an identifying marker. Everybody knew. Everybody knew who Bubba was, right? You know, if somebody would have walked
in. Maybe in terms of surname, it was just like by calling someone just by the surname, which even now can sometimes, right. You know, it can be kind of endearing, or it can also be a little bit annoying at times. Someone just, you know, right. Someone calls me, hey, Kerwin, you know, it could be, you know, depending on the context, it's not the same as someone calling me by my first name. So maybe right. He wouldn't do that. Maybe he would only call them by their surname instead of just calling them by their first name as well.
Right. When my daughter was young, she had like, you know how it is, like there's certain names in any grade that are very popular. So there were like five little girls named Shira in her class. So the only way to keep track of them was to call, they called them all by their last names, right? So one girl they called Leibovitz, and one girl they called Adler, and one girl they called something. So I remember one of the fathers saying, it's like the army. It's second grade, and it's like, the, you know, because in the army, you always get called by your last name. Right, so it's like second grade girl army. They all go by their last name. But Rashi seems to say any kind of nickname, even just an identifying nickname, he was careful not to call. I don't know. I mean, it sounds to me, and other Mefarshim say that he was careful not to call people by the derogatory names, or even by the regular, like garden. You know, there are plenty of people that prefer their nickname to their given name. Right, my father never goes by his legal name. He hated it. He's still angry at his parents, 77 years later that they gave him that name. And he only goes by his nickname. My grandfather had a nickname. Nobody knew his. I didn't know my grandfather's real name. I thought that was his name until I was like much older. And somebody, no, that's not his real name. That's his nickname. You know, in that generation, everybody in that family, everybody had a nickname. Nobody went by their birth certificate name. This one was named Sonny, and that one's name was Seymour, but everybody called him David. And another guy's name was Moogie for some. You know, they had all these crazy nicknames. But Rav Adabarava thought it wasn't proper. A person's name is their name, and it's their identity, and that's who they are. Anyway, these were the things that he cataloged. These are not halachot, you understand. We're not obligated to take on these virtuous practices, but they were virtuous.
Excuse
he,
me.
He thought,
excuse me. What, yeah. What century did he live in?
Rav Adabarava? I don't know. Third, somebody can Google it. Third century Bavel? I'm not sure.
I see.
He was an Amora. He lived in Bavel in the times of the Gemara. Not the fourth century Bavel.
Fourth century. Thank you. I'm just curious to know what the genre was in that particular era.
Yeah.
And then with Pirkei Avos, to me, Pirkei Avos is very prime. Everything is there.
Right. Well, Pirkei Avot is a different. Pirkei Avot is a work of the Tanaim in Eretz Yisrael. That was at least a century, if not more, earlier. And this is the Amoraim in Babylonia, you know, at some subsequent point. So the Gemara goes on. Omer le Rava le Raphram Bar Papa. Raphram Bar Papa, who we mostly know when we get to the Siyum. Lema lan mar mehane mili ma'alyata dahava avid Rav Huna. So he says, tell us, Rava says to Raphram Bar Papa, who was an older rabbinic figure, he says, let the master tell us some of these ma'aliyot, some of these exalted, elevated character traits of Rav Huna, right? Tell us, you know, anybody who's spent 10 minutes in yeshiva will recognize this, right? You know, you want to know stories, tell us the Rebbe stories, right? Tell us the tales of, in Yeshivat Har Etzion over here, you can go in any day of the week and there's always some older guy telling wonder stories of Rabbi Lichtenstein, Zichrono Levracha. But you always have to wonder about some of these stories, like how they got to us. Like some of them are already exaggerated. Because in many of the stories, the only witness to the story is Rabbi Lichtenstein himself. And the one thing we know for sure is that he would not have gone around bragging about his virtues. So you always have to wonder, what's the reception history of this story? So he says, tell us some of those stories of Rav Huna, the wonder stories of his righteousness. So Omer Lei, Biyankute lo dekerna. I don't remember any stories of him when he was young. Besevuta dekerna. But I do remember some of the wonder stories of his righteousness from when he was already a saba, when he was already older. Dechol yoma de'eva hava mafkin le begu Guraka Guharka de Dahava. On every cloudy day, they would take him out in a golden carriage. Visayer Leila Chulamata. And they would drive him around. They would drive Rav Huna around the whole area, the whole city. Vachola Shita Dahavat Ruuta Hava Satarle. And any wall, this is going back to the original topic, any place he would do on cloudy days, he would go out and do building inspections. And wherever he saw a shaky wall, a wall that looked like it was going to collapse, he would have the workmen tear it down. Efshalemara bonale. And if the master of the house, if the homeowner could afford it, he would rebuild it. Ve'ilo efshar bona le'ihu medide. And if the homeowner couldn't afford to put the wall back up, he, Rav Huna, would pay for it. So, first, I don't know why it's a golden carriage. Maybe it's a golden carriage because he was so wealthy, Rav Huna, that he could drive around in a golden carriage. So why would Rav Huna go around showing off his wealth in a fancy golden Cadillac? Because it's appropriate. In other words, what was he doing? He was going around condemning other people's property. But out of his own pocket, he was paying to have it rebuilt. In other words, why might somebody not affect home repairs in their own home if safety requires it? You know, there are all types of home repairs that we do because we want to live in nice homes, right? The walls get dirty. You want to do a paint job every now and again, every couple of years. But it's not required. You can live in a home with children's handprints on the wall. And anybody who has children, I had an aunt. I had an Aunt Libby who would, you'd walk into her house. She'd say, "Welcome to my home. Don't touch the walls." But everybody except Aunt Libby, you know, if you have children in your life, you have handprints on the walls. And, but then there are home repairs that have to be done because the home is unsafe. So not everybody, why do people neglect to do repairs on homes that are not safe? Because they can't afford it. So he understood that. So he would go around condemning people's homes if they were unsafe, for their safety and for the safety of the public good, so that walls don't go collapsing around on people. But then, if the people couldn't afford to rebuild their homes, which they're obligated to do, if your home is unsafe, you have an obligation to make it safe for yourself and for others. But if they couldn't afford it, he would pay for it out of a great act of tzedakah, of charity. He would pay for it out of his own pocket. So showing that sometimes showing that you're a wealthy man is not arrogant, right? It was a way of justifying this act to say, I'm going to do this, but don't worry. I'm going to take care of the public good out of my own pocket because safety first, because the safety of the residents of our town is the most important thing. Why was this done on a cloudy day? So Rashi, we only have a minute left. Rashi says, what was the point of a cloudy? Why not do it on a sunny day? Why not do it on a cloudy day? Because cloudy means cloudy. Cloudy means rainy. Rainy means wind. These were days when the weather was such that it heightened the danger of building collapses. You know, like they always tell you before a big storm, before there's going to be a nor'easter, you know, in America, or a big rainstorm, they tell you got to batten down the hatches. Don't leave your garden furniture laying around where it can go flying off and smashing into somebody's window. You know, in some places they board up, they put that plywood in front of the showroom windows, because chachamena barosho, you have to know what to do. So that's the reason. That's perhaps the reason why he would do this specifically on the cloudy days. Okay, I'm sorry, we have to call it a day here. But the Gemara goes on with another story of Raphaim Bar Papa of Rav Huna, and we'll pick that up next week. Okay,
thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for joining us, Rhoda. Enjoy
oh,
and check out the other
much.
Shurim on Web Yeshiva, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Kol hakavod.